listening to KYRS Medical Lake Spokane 88.1 and 92.3 FM. Good afternoon. You're listening to KYRS. The show is Praxis. The time is 4 on a Monday. I'm your host, Taylor, and today I've got another, what I think will be a great interview, lined up, and Bill All will be here in the studio in just a few minutes, joining me to talk about, since this is a show about activism and about making social change, about how to sustain that on a personal level and on a movement level, because I know I don't know anyone who identifies as an activist or an organizer or even just someone who's engaged in the day-to-day political life who has not experienced some degree of burnout in their time doing that. And I think it accelerates during challenging times. So he's been doing all kinds of different social change work in a variety of contexts for decades. And he has some really good insight on that. So we're going to talk about that pretty soon here. I do want to do a quick follow-up on last week's show. If you missed it, it was a really fun panel. I learned a ton from the three women who I had in roundtable with me last week. I was talking with some of the lead organizers of the No Discrimination Spokane Coalition, Nagmana Ahmed Shirazi, Lily Navarrete, and Puyan Lam. And the three of them, all immigrant women, all organizing around immigrant rights in Spokane. And they shared two important dates, which are now suddenly upon us. So they were on the show encouraging folks to come out and testify and pay attention to the city council vote, which is happening tonight, just in 2 hours, if you're listening live, at 6 p.m. at Spokane City Hall, down on Spokane Falls Boulevard. The city is considering an ordinance that would ban Border Patrol and ICE from non-public areas in the city, including the Intermodal Center, where the Greyhound buses, Northwest Trailways buses, and Amtrak all pass through Spokane. At that location, Border Patrol and ICE have been boarding the buses and demanding to see people's papers without a specific warrant. This ordinance would prevent that from happening on non-public property, which the Intermodal Center is. So that is happening tonight. I'm sure they would want me to remind you of that. And also tomorrow, Tuesday, October 23rd at 11 a.m. At the Court of Appeals, which is at 500 North Cedar, right by the courthouse, there, the proposition that brought the No Discrimination Spokane Coalition together, Proposition 1, was beat in court. It would have licensed all city employees, not just law enforcement, but all city employees to demand proof of citizenship from those they suspected of being non-citizens. So it was a really, really extreme racial profiling type initiative targeting immigrants in our community. It was overturned in court. The group who put it together, Respect Washington, is appealing its overturning in court on Tuesday. So they are also asking for your support there. So that's just some follow-up from last week. If you missed the show, I highly recommend you track it down and listen to it. You can find it on my SoundCloud. You can find it on the podcast by looking up Praxis, either in iTunes, Google Play Music, pretty much wherever you get your podcasts, or you can go directly to soundcloud.com/praxisradio, PRAXISRADIO, and hear that show and other past shows. So, yeah. But today, as I said, we're going to be talking about, we're not going to so much be talking about burnout as we are preemptive things that you can do. We're talking about sustaining your activism, sustaining these movements long term, because while it might seem, I think especially during these seasons, during midterm elections, during elections in general, a lot of people get into this mindset that, oh, if we just win this one thing, if we can just win at the polls, then, you know, we'll be on the downslope and we'll be cruising to victory. And that's not necessarily how it works. And often, you know, there's a burst of energy during these seasons, but the work that we need to do, the cultural work, the broader work, the political work, the movement work, continues all the time. And if you're someone who's engaged in that work all the time, either as a professional, a paid organizer, a paid position of some kind, or just as a really committed agitator of whatever type, even I think journalists can fall into this. I think a lot of different people can. It tends to open you up to the risk of what is referred to as burnout. And I just want to say, I mean, burnout isn't exclusive to activists and activist communities. It can happen to anyone in any line of work. But, and this is something I hope to discuss with Bill in just a couple minutes, is there's some specific cultures within activism, in the worlds of activism, that I think can make this problem worse, but that also lend us some better solutions. So this is kind of from a pamphlet that I found on this that actually talks about activist trauma, which is a frame that I hadn't really used to think about it. And I think I need to think about that more. But they talk about, these are some warning signs of burnout. So if this burnout is happening to you, they say, burnout happens slowly over a long period of time. It's expressed physically and or mentally. Symptoms of burnout can include a creeping feeling that activism is taking over your life, difficulty in making decisions, inability to stay focused, insomnia, difficulty sleeping or getting enough sleep, a growing tendency to think negatively, pervasive feelings of hopelessness, a loss of sense of purpose and energy. And then they say physical indications of burnout include muscle tension, restriction of blood flow to the tissues, and increased adrenaline buildup. These physiological signs can lead to headache, backache, and exhaustion, a loss of pleasure in food, friends, or other activities that were once exciting and interesting, a general sense of running on empty. They say other warning signs include temper tantrums over trivial matters, not wanting to get out of bed in the morning, or becoming accident prone. And I was just laughing at temper tantrums over trivial matters, because the second layer of this issue is that when individuals are experiencing this burnout, it can have ripple effects through a community. Imagine, maybe a lot of you who are listening, who are involved in this world, don't have to imagine that one person in your community is feeling this way, and just the ripple effects that can have through an organization, through a club at school, through a political party, through a family, you know? So these are serious issues that can really inhibit our ability to be effective in our movements that we're trying to build. And I guess just, I'll probably get into this more with Bill in just a couple minutes, but on a personal level, having been involved, the reason that I do this show, for listeners who might be new, the reason I started doing it back in 2012 in the first iteration, is that at that point I had been involved in activism, both on the nonprofit end and in the volunteer end, for about 4 years. And I was seeing all of these patterns, and I was becoming increasingly frustrated with the model in nonprofits specifically. And just seeing both individuals and systems not working in an optimum way. And I started to wonder, what is the optimum way? Is there an optimum way? Spoiler, I've since learned that I don't think there is. There's not one way. But there are some general principles we can abide by. There's some general ways of being that we can pursue that can make us more effective in our work together. So through that, you know, I've continued doing my own personal stuff, activism wise, but I've leaned more toward the stuff in this show, looking at how it works for other people and what the patterns and systems that we can pull out of the broader stuff looks like. So, but I know that just in my personal activism life, I've experienced most of the symptoms on that list of burnout. So, and I'm being joined now by Bill Aull. So I'll let him get settled in. You can either sit next to me or across from me. It doesn't matter. So, but just make sure you're right up on the microphone. So Yep. So if you want to just introduce yourself, talk a little bit about who you are and what you do.
Sure. My name's Bill Aul, and I lived in Spokane the last 3 or 4 years now. I'm involved with the Peace and Justice Action League of Spokane, and also I have a organization called Tools for Change, which works with looking at how do we sustain activism through understanding of our politics, the power dynamics that go on in our organizations, and sometimes I teach a meditation practice that helps people to get centered and clear about what their purpose is. So I've been around for a while, and I've worked with a lot of different activists and a lot of different organizations, and seeing what doesn't work and seeing what does work, and hope that we can do more in Spokane to improve the sustainability of our activist lives.
Yeah, and I was just going through this list that I found that kind of, I was also saying I've done activism stuff for a while, you know, proportionate to my life, and I know what burnout looks like and feels like, but I was looking up what they actually list the symptoms of. What does burnout look like for individuals? And I just wonder if you want to speak to that at all. Like what about activism specifically can lead to these issues?
Well, it's not just about activism. It's that we're in a world where, and in particular in a country, where a lot of what we would value as good for our humanity and good for the planet is being ignored by a large number of people and by the power structures that are. So when we go up against it, time after time, it feels overwhelming. So that's one piece. Another piece is that we have not been taught what my comrades used to call revolutionary patience, that it takes a while to get stuff done, and that we've been in it for at least 500 years, so it might take a few decades to get us out of it. So there's a feeling of hopelessness, at least that comes up sometimes for me when I think, oh my God, it's the same thing as it was 10 years ago or 20 years ago. We're facing the same odds. But that's also because I fail to look at all of the positive and wonderful things that have happened in our communities. Mm-hmm. So that's another part. And then the last piece is, as a white man, I know that white privilege has a lot to do with my thinking about what success looks like. So it has to be immediate. It has to be something that's measurable. It has to be something that gives me a sense of accomplishment as opposed to thinking about what my community or the world might need.
Mm-hmm. So. And that's, I think you nailed it, talking about white privilege and talking about power systems in general, because mm-hmm. we learn all these models through capitalism mm-hmm. and whatnot that we need to work ourselves to death to have mm-hmm. value.
Right.
And then I think specifically in kind of the nonprofit world, that wing of quote unquote activist work, there's this second layer that, you know, we're fighting for this great noble cause mm-hmm. so that you should do even more of that work.
Right.
You know, there's a.
Yeah, totally. And there's a piece of guilt in having the privilege growing up with it, even if we didn't recognize that we had the privilege, that sometimes can be in there. There's also, when we're doing for other people as opposed to doing for our own families and communities, there's another layer of separation between us and what a positive outcome might look like. So it then becomes something that we're doing for others, and so then we're not getting the satisfaction of feeling it inside ourselves often.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So I was also kind of I was just getting in when you came in to the ways that an individual person within a movement, within an organization, within a party, whatever mm-hmm. the context is, burning out can have a ripple effect on broader work. Can you speak to having seen that?
I think it's, again, I was talking to one of our friends who's been in the movement for a bit too, and who's experienced challenges in her own activist life. And so I asked her what we should be talking about on the radio today. And she said, well, how can we work to create communities of support for each other where we're actually lifted up? And so that's part of it. And it's also communities where if Bill gets tired or Taylor gets overwhelmed, that there's enough interconnections and enough strength in our communities that if we need to step back, there's a matrix in which that can happen. And so that means that we get support, but also that we're not the only ones doing this work. So if I stop publishing the web blog, somebody else can step in to do it. Nobody can replace you on the radio, but, you know.
I beg to differ. They're out there. They're going to have to be out there in a couple years when I take off.
So we need to build leadership that's not based on individuals alone, but that is collective leadership and that we have each other's back, even when we're not burnt out. So that when burnout happens or somebody gets sick in my family or some other thing that makes it impossible for me to step forwards at that moment, I'm not feeling the weight of the whole thing collapsing.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that that's part of it. So yeah, we oftentimes build these movements we think we're building movements, that's a whole other thing, but we build organizations anyway based on the charismatic power of one person who's got the drive and the vision and is the person up front. And when they collapse or something happens to them for various reasons or they have to step back, then who's going to fill the void? And we have to start organizing in a different way than that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can speak to the positive that I have seen in mm-hmm. getting lucky enough to be part of a couple of organizations and zones where it was strong enough for me to get deathly ill. You know, unfortunately, that's what it took for me to realize to break some of those thought patterns in my mm-hmm. own mind that mm-hmm. like, oh, it's all up to me. And I have this kind of martyr thing of like, if I don't do it, it's not going to get done. And then to realize not in control of everything mm-hmm. and guess what? The world didn't end and mm-hmm. things got done and some things got done better because mm-hmm. you got to have that rotation of leadership and work.
Exactly. I think another piece of that is how do we have a collective vision? That everybody has to have the same vision, but how do we have a vision of a Spokane that's going to look like a different city or county in the next 5 or 10 years? So we actually start to think of the long term as well. So we're building not just for campaigns, but for the long term. And it's not just about me and my organization, but about us, about we and the who are trying to make Spokane a better place. And so that not just on an individual basis, but on an organizational basis, there might be times when somebody has, an organization has to step back. So we're creating a vision and a set of structures that are going to support us for the long term.
Mm-hmm. And so you've done this in different places and mm-hmm. different types of organizations mm-hmm. and movements. What do you think is the common thread? You've got to some of it, but in what makes successful, and again, that's kind of an mm-hmm. elusive term in itself, but what makes sturdy, healthy movements? And
Well, again, I think the other piece is that things change over time. So where there's strength for one moment, it might not be the next. But when I first came to Spokane, what I noticed about the Peace and Justice Action League, and the reason I got involved was it looked very similar to an organization I'd been in Seattle, where there were one or two really strong leaders, but who understood that they couldn't do it alone and that were building organization and building relationships with other organizations that were more than just about doing the work. And I think that's a key piece. So that in the Community Alliance for Global Justice in Seattle, which looks at strengthening local economies everywhere. So looks at sustainable agriculture, looks at the global economy, looks at issues of race and class within the farming system, and gender, of course. We get a lot of work done. I'm still involved. I'm going to Senegal in a week to be a part of a group of people who are dedicated to food sovereignty. And the reason I'm mentioning that is that CAGJ has been around for about 12 years, not 40 like P. Giles, but has some longevity with a very small budget and a very active team. And what we notice is that people tend to stay around for a long, long time because they're feeling seen. So I think that's a big piece of it. And that people are thinking about their leadership, and I'm using that term in a broad sense. It might not be that you're head of a committee or an organization, but that people are looking to you for your passion and your expertise about whatever issue that you're involved in, or that you're just wanting to support an organization. But that's leadership too. It doesn't all have to look like being on the radio or the front lines.
Yeah, bringing stuff to the potluck.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And being recognized for bringing stuff to the potluck. That's mm-hmm. a key piece when you're thinking how to build an organization or a community, is like people see each other and can feel that. So then accountability becomes a different thing. It's not simply measured by how much you do, but now you're wanting to do stuff because if you don't, I don't want to say it that way, if you do something, people are going to notice and it's going to make a difference, no matter how small. Mm-hmm. So I think that's one key piece. And the second thing, I mentioned vision before, I think that PGILS and this Community Alliance for Global Justice have a vision of a just society and have some teeth to that vision. And I'm not going to outline all those things, but that you can actually feel the possibility mm-hmm. when you're working together in those kinds of groups. And then female leadership. and it's not like men don't have a role to play in leadership, but that we have egalitarian organizations in which the leadership of women, young people, and people of color are really valued, and not in the abstract, but in the concrete. And I think that those are really key pieces to creating sustainable organizations. In mm-hmm. fact, most organizing is done by women, whether it's in the churches or in the political parties or in nonprofits. Mm-hmm. Not that there's not a lot of strong male leadership, but when you look at the everyday work, that's many times that's where it's coming from.
Hmm. I'll take that.
Yeah.
if you're just joining us, you're listening to Praxis on KYRS. I'm here talking with Bill Aull, who works with both Peace and Justice Action League here in Spokane, has a website, toolsforchange.org, that does a lot of support work for individuals and for groups and for nonprofits. And we're talking about sustaining activism. So,
yeah. The other part is, as I was saying, that patience is a really important thing. And patience, not like we have to defer what's best for us, but patience in seeing that it's going to take a while to achieve some of the things that we'd like to achieve, and thinking a bit strategically about how to get there. It's something that we often use that word, but it's not like a strategy that you spend 10 weeks working on a strategic plan and then you put it on the desk and nobody ever uses it. But how to think about strategy, building towards the long term, thinking about what's changing in your environment, in our environment, that is going to cause us to shift course a little bit. There's a really great book called Emergent Strategy that several of us have been reading around town and around the country. And I think it's probably time to do a book group around it. And is it Marie Brown? Anne Marie Brown.
I think so. Yeah.
Anne Marie Brown wrote this amazing book. She's a young organizer of color who's done some really amazing work and started to try to think through like what were the elements of her sustaining herself and sustaining the movement. And one big piece of that is the piece around self-care, which we've just touched on a little bit. And I know there's lots to say about that. And the other is about developing strategic thinking that can be flexible. So we try this, we see what's working, we move to the next step, and so on. And it's a really great book. It's an antidote to the kind of like, oh my God, everything is overwhelming, we're never going to get anywhere kind of feeling that I get sometimes, especially in this this moment.
Yeah. Yeah. I think a lot of people do. And it's been interesting since the 2016 election, I've got to watch a lot of brand new activists go through this cycle in a really quick, their first cycle. Hopefully it's not their last. For some, it might be their last for a while because they weren't supported in that way you were talking about. But to say, oh my gosh, there's a problem. I'm going to do everything I can for 3 months. And then I'm going to hit the wall of hopelessness and crash and burn.
Right.
And hopefully then, you know, we're these more long-term people. That's a role of elders in the movement. That's a role of institutions to say, actually, no, that was just one go around the track and we're going to keep going and we're going to figure it out and improve next time.
Yeah. I was on a phone call today with people from around the world, actually, and we were asking what keeps us going. And a lot of it was some kind of belief in the future or the belief that humans and the natural world deserve us to do that. And the other part was knowing how to party well. And also, as we were talking about, when to step back. I'm actually thinking a bit about a friend of mine, and even though she's younger, I see her as a mentor. Her name is Mayit Dalila. She's been organizing in Seattle for a long time, first doing work around AIDS, and she was really involved in a People of Color Against AIDS network, where she worked day and night for 10 years and gave up everything, including having children, which is important to her, and a lot of her personal life. And she finally hit a wall and she went totally flat. She just could not pick herself up. And her elders told her, you need to take 5 years off. It didn't take her that long, but she had to give herself enough space to begin to rebuild her life and to remember why she was doing the work. And in the aftermath of that, she built an organization in Seattle called Inter-African Connections, which is about supporting African people, African descent people, and throughout the diaspora, throughout the Seattle area and across the nation and in hemisphere, to understand the value of their culture and their history and why it was important, not just important, but crucial to be organizing together for rebuilding the culture. And that's, she's been doing that for 20 years now, and helped to build a really vibrant set of other organizations around healthcare and education for the young people and so on. And you would never know that she couldn't even talk about any of this stuff for several years anyway.
And that sounds like, so it sounds like she's working on really specific things. And I think that's, I know that's part of my challenge. And a lot of people in my generation who have grown up with this, you know, intense, overwhelming digital culture. And if you care about things socially, there's a lot of pressure to know about, first of all, and then to care about and be involved in all of the things. Can you speak to that a little bit?
It's not just that. I totally agree that there's a attention deficit challenge with all the information overload. But another friend of mine who's named Charlie Barron in the Bay Area, he's a comic. He does wonderful one-person shows down in the Bay Area. And in the 80s, he hit his moment. He'd been involved in anti-nuclear stuff and Central America stuff. And there was Reagan, and it was just going on and on and on. And he went into a depression for a long time. And two things came out of that that I think are great tools. One is he was so depressed he couldn't get out of bed. It was like that. And so he just, and he couldn't figure out whether it was global warming or, you know, the threat of the oil crisis or whatever, or, you know, Reagan was our current, you know, was equally challenging as our current president. And he came up with a worry meter, so he pulls out in his comic routine, okay, today I'm going to spin the dial and I'll see what I'm going to worry about today, and the rest of it I'm not going to worry about. So that's one tool. And the second thing is he watched the preachers on the television, the evangelists on the television, back when they were in their heyday, mm-hmm. there's still a lot. And he developed a preaching on evolution that is really brilliant. And I still have this little piece on hopelessness that he wrote. And he talks about the dinosaur having a pea brain and thrashing around in the, you know, Jurassic age. And did he create a nuclear weapon that could wipe out the world? No, that takes intelligence, et cetera, et cetera. So he talks a lot about hopelessness and individualism in that pamphlet, and it's a really great little Bible tract, if you will, on how to lift yourself up. So there's always been a multiple choices about where we put our attention. I think there's two pieces of that. Is yes, it's important to focus on one thing and then another, perhaps. And that's really true. But when we look at it, we have to understand that there are certain principles that are underlying all of the challenges that we're facing. And so it's like, how do you create a unitary vision that understands that each issue is interconnected, but that you can only do one thing at a time? Mm-hmm. So that, especially now with so much information flow, to pick an area that you're interested in and then to work with others to find out what needs to be done. And then if a campaign is useful, that's definitely an approach. But what we also have to fight against is I'm an environmentalist, so I can't deal with social issues, or I'm a social justice person, so what's this about farming? You know, why are you talking about that to me? And that we have to understand the common cause underneath that, or the common threads that want, you know, that braid us together, maybe is better than one cause. And so it's kind of like, you know, close vision and far, distance vision. Mm-hmm. We need both of them in order to keep going for the long term, because we can get so specialized in our thinking. And because of the nature of the nonprofit industrial complex, which we could talk about, and the way that ego gets involved, we may channel ourselves so narrowly that we can't see that we're actually part of a broad movement and that we all need each other. And that's how they get to pick us off. Mm-hmm. They meaning whoever is actually looking out. If you look at the Republicans and the corporations, they started in the 60s to organize to the extent that we have the situation we have today. There's so many different twists and turns. But after Barry Goldwater got defeated back in the early 60s, the corporations really started to say, we're getting our asses beat here. We got to start to do something. And so they started developing organizing institutes for their work. What became mass mailing in the 80s was starting to be developed back in the early 60s as people mm-hmm. started to try to look at that, which is now where we, you know, developed into the Facebook and other social mm-hmm. media craziness. So they thought long term. There's mm-hmm. many more things creating
started
think
tanks. Consolidating the media.
Yep.
Corporate yep. media.
Yeah, and building lots of local small groups to get local officials elected, which then could, you know, come up the ladder and to take over the Republican Party too. So
yeah.
So we need to think that long term. And to focus, like you were saying, is really good. And then step back and have a broad focus.
Mm-hmm. And I'm trying to think of how this linked together in my mind when you were talking. But you, in your work, mm-hmm. And I'm hearing more of this, which I'm glad that I'm hearing more of it in the last few years, focusing on power systems, both mm-hmm. on the micro and the macro level.
Mm-hmm.
How does that tie in to what you were just talking about? Like, how does addressing our own internalized white supremacy uh-huh. fit in with sustaining our movements?
That's a good question or two. Let me see if I can untangle it for myself. So when I have... You know, Taylor, you and I were talking a lot about conflict in the past couple of weeks, not about conflict between us, but about how to support individuals and organizations to mm-hmm. think about trauma. And I was putting forward that there's sort of multiple levels. And when I'm in an organization, I bring in all the stuff I started with outside. I grew up in this society where I was privileged as a white male, not because I chose it, but because I was born in a certain way and enculturated in a certain way. And so a lot of the assumptions I have about the world that are informed by white supremacy, I get to work on. But I bring that in into my relationship, say, with PJALs or with an individual. And so I might just expect that I'm the one who's, and I'm college educated, and even though I grew up working class and middle class, so I'm sort of been scripted by society to assume that I know the answer, that I can fix things, that I got to do it by myself. There's a whole set of messages that I have that make it really likely that I'm going to end up in a conflict with somebody who doesn't have those assumptions, for sure, and I might walk all over them. And if I'm not in an organization or in a relationship where we've normalized being able to talk about that and to have me called out about it, I'm never going to understand, well, why doesn't X person want to work with me anymore? You know, I'm a good guy. I intended well, but I just happened to take up 80% of the airtime, and that person just got tired of it and they can't deal with it. That's a minor example. So when I start to understand for myself how white supremacy has isolated me from other folks, including other white men, but from other people that I'm trying to work with, I might be able to break it down a little bit and step back, not because I did something wrong, the impact was wrong, but because I'm going to be able to create more loving and effective relationships. So that's one small example. When we think about it in the context of organizations, it's like, well, why don't we get more X's, trans people or people of color or women in our leadership or in our organization or to come to our events? Well, we hold them in the Westin building or the big hotel downtown,
Davenport.
Or at the Davenport.
Spokane's
right?
Westin.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. I'm still Seattle-centric. Yeah. See, there's lots of oppression in the world, including all my assumptions about Spokane. But or at the university or like that, as opposed to trying to find other places to hold venues. Or I invite a Native American to come to my organization to bless this thing and never ask them what their thinking is about the issue, or, you know, to tokenize their presence. And then I'm surprised that they don't want to do that. It's like, well, we're extending an invitation, but we haven't analyzed what it really takes to be in relationship. So that's another part of white supremacy, is oftentimes that we're not in relationship to ourselves, to each other, or to the wider world. So when we break that down individually and organizationally, it's not about being bad people. It's about how we want to be humans. Mm-hmm. And then that can become the basis for creating a more effective organization.
Mm-hmm. And then it seems like as we address that, then we're able to have, that seems like it's the bottom of the pyramid in mm-hmm. some ways, because then we can have those strong, authentic relationships
yeah.
and that network that keeps the whole thing.
Right. And again, it's not linear. Mm-hmm. It's like, I'm not all of a sudden going to become woke, or even if I could. It's a process. And so what I want to do is keep trying things and reaching out beyond where I feel comfortable, and then recognize, oh, I made a mistake there. Mm-hmm. And if I'm in a context where with a person of color who I'm trying to work with, and they're kind enough to point that out to me, and I'm open to it, then I change a little bit. And then that relationship gets more trust. And so like that. So again, the linear process, it's not. It is starting with an understanding, you know, reading, doing workshops, blah, blah, blah.
Mm-hmm.
Not asking my friends of color to help me sort this out, but to really start doing the work. That does create a base, but it's not going to be like all of a sudden now I'm done with all of my...
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then stuff. We all yeah. reach nirvana at the same time, and we yeah, win wow. social justice. And
right.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Darn, that would be so easy. yeah, I want to loop back and make sure we talk about self-care. It's definitely becoming a conversation,
mm-hmm.
Definitely being mainstreamed in this world.
Mm-hmm.
I think sometimes in a way that's challenging, though, because it can feel like, oh, I'm so overwhelmed. And now I have to do self-care. Like, it becomes yet another box on the to-do list.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
So what's functional self-care look like to you?
I'll check in with you about that, too, because... But, and there's another part of it, which is sometimes we feel like, oh, well, that's all I can do. And if I just work on myself, isn't that enough? And so it's, again, it's this balancing act. Everybody has a different way of taking care of themselves. There's not one or two or even three classes you can go to do that. But I think that the first piece is to find out, like, where is your passion and where's your heart? It's one piece. Because if you find yourself doing work that isn't connecting to your heart, but just to your head, then you're probably going to burn out. So that's one piece of self-care, is to connect. Second, at least for me, I find if I am doing, white middle-class male patterning, then I never take time to reflect and I don't take care of myself. And I might even guilt myself into going to five more meetings that I shouldn't have gone to, and then I might show up late at a radio show.
Hypothetically.
Yeah, no. Hypothetically. But just, you know, there's ways in which I have to begin to watch how much I'm doing and able to do at any one point in my life. And I do teach a meditation practice called applied meditation, and I try to work with it myself as much as I can, which is a kind of problem-solving meditation, and it works with your imagination and intuition and mindfulness. But that's just one practice that helps me to create a new relationship with both inside myself and outside. So I think that that's another part. And then cultivating friends is another piece. And all the other things that you should do. But I think the main thing is asking, what do you need at any one moment? And trying to create that's a practice you can do with that doesn't take a lot of extra energy, right? You don't have to go to a class to say, okay, am I too tired right now?
Did I drink any water today?
Right, exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And what food is good for me? All those things. And frankly, sitting in a chair all day in front of a computer screen, which one can tend to do in our jobs, in our individual activism, that's not a very good way to live, in my mind. So I try to get outside as much as I can. And some days they're better than others for that. So what about you? What are pieces of self-care that work for you?
Oh, goodness. I mean, I've really had to figure that out in an extreme way, dealing with some chronic illness stuff and things like that. Definitely unplugging from digital life, particularly social media. Mm-hmm. I find myself on it less and less. Yep. I try to be mindfully on it if I'm on it, to say, okay, I'm going to take half an hour and catch up with who I need to catch up with and not just scroll. That makes my brain go into self-destruct mode pretty quickly. So that, definitely going outside to having other people around. Mm-hmm. Also having non-activism related interests and relationships.
Good idea.
That's something I forget about all the time. That then I'm like, oh, I'm just I'm in a group right now. This is going to reveal some of my inner nerdiness, but I'm in a group doing Dungeons and Dragons right now the first time.
Yay.
And like, that isn't related to activism or organizing at all. But it's also... I have to restrain myself because I'm like, oh, I can apply all of these things. This is interpersonal, you know, dynamics. Yeah. And like, there's power relationships playing out. So, you know, I have to restrain myself from making everything about it. But those are the things that tend to help me.
And as you were speaking, I was also reminded of, it's not just having friends outside. It actually gives me a different perspective when I'm not just with my activist friends. I start to see the world differently. I might, in those moments, which is kind of helpful because then it gives me a little bit more spaciousness to reflect. Mm-hmm. So I think there's that. And having fun is a good thing.
Yeah.
The creative outlets, all of us have different ways of being creative. But to really be creative just for the sake of creativity is really a wonderful thing. whether it's singing or Dungeons and Dragons or cooking or wherever it is, having some place that you're being for the sake of being. That's the other part. As opposed to, we have to get this done.
How do you think, have you seen good examples of that ethic being part of an organizational culture or like a group culture?
That's a really good question. Well, one of the things that I really appreciate about CAGJ's work culture is that a lot of vacation time is built in. And it's they only have two staff and it's a very small budget, but people are really encouraged to really take, you know, at least a week off a quarter to just do something, not to go to an event or get to go to a training. And so I think when you're in a paid staff position, to really try to create more, as much spaciousness as possible for that just being time. I think in PGILS, one of the things I really appreciate is that there's business meetings for the steering committee and there's Fire in the Belly, which is still topic related, but is more spacious, a chance to explore something that's really important to everybody in more depth. So I think that those are a couple of examples. And I think the other thing that is really important is, it's hard to find time just to hang out because there's so much to do, but actually finding time to go to have dinner with your comrades and colleagues and friends. I think again, in the PGILS ecosystem, there's the marching band, there's this folks who are singing, which are related, and just so the interweaving of creative space and the campaign-oriented stuff is really key. And just how do we flow with that? Not that everybody has to do everything, but there's a space to create relationships that's outside of the meeting or the protest.
Also, I think another aspect of that I've noticed with some of the organizations I work with that I like and that I stay with because I like is celebrating victories.
Yes.
You know, not just saying, oh, we won that thing, but we're still underwater. It's still the Trump presidency. It's still whatever, the end of the world. But to take that moment and say, you know what, we did a really good job and let's all party together, like you said.
Yeah.
Bring that way.
And mourn the losses, because one of the things that's really challenging for us is to not just evaluate and do that, but to actually let our feelings of loss and grief be present with each other. Not that we want to create pity parties or something, but just that there's a way in which, man, that really feels bad. And I remember right after the elections, there was some space for that in Spokane. We did an energy circle, which is one of the forms of applied meditation, where there was four or five or six of us that came together and just talked about what was heavy on our hearts as part of the process we were doing. And to be able to acknowledge that with each other allows us to show up more as human beings. And again, deepens the trust level and allows us to be all of who we are, not just the think tank or the campaign organizer or the protest sign maker or whatever. So, you know, to really feel that and not to, there's a woman who's named Joanna Macy, who I might bring in here, who's been a Buddhist scholar and an activist for a lot of her life. And she's developed actual rituals for people to be able to express their grief and fear and sorrow, not to stay in it, but to be able to share it in a way that allows us to move through it collectively and to do it in a structured way. Rituals are a really important part of our lives. We have marches. We have committee meetings we go to. We go down to city council. Those are actually kind of ritualized ways that we show up for each other. But they don't allow us to have space to express all of who we are. But, you know, we could go a long ways in this conversation about that. But to create spaces where we can express our grief for the world, we can express our hope for our families, we can express the anger that we feel with each other and hold it rather than when we're on the, let me say it differently, when we're out there on the streets and the alt-right folks are coming at us and trying to infiltrate us and egg us on, we've had a place to share our anger that is in a place that can be held as opposed to having to go off on them or to just stuff my anger because it's not appropriate in that place. I'm not saying it's not appropriate to stop the right wing and the Nazis from doing what they're doing, but how I hold my anger is going to be different.
Mm-hmm.
It comes back to that word mindfulness that you were talking about.
Yeah, that strikes me what you were saying earlier about democratizing leadership and taking it out of the stereotypical patriarchal white zone, which is about, it's sad. It makes me sad for men and for white men specifically. It's about segmenting off your feelings and being a very compartmentalized person. And I think when we have more diverse leadership, there is room for, you know, let's be our full selves and let's...
Yeah. Exactly.
Realize our emotions are a strength, you know.
Right. And actually, white folks and white men in particular are really diverse. We just don't allow, we're not allowed to show that. So that this focus on diversity and making sure diverse perspectives are heard from means that we get to take our rightful place in the mix. Not our rightful place in the mix and from up on high, but as part of the whole thing. And then I can show up as my unique self as opposed to white guy, right?
Yeah.
And authentically.
Mm-hmm.
And you can show up as who you are. And then we can, like, hold each other with respect and compassion.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. What else? Somehow we only have, like, 2 or 3 minutes left.
Oh, my
goodness.
That
just kind of, like, flew by. For me, I hope it did for you. What do you want to make sure that we get out there? Whether it's resources for people, questions for people to ask themselves, anything you want to make sure we hit.
Yeah. Well, if you're feeling, I guess, if you're feeling overwhelmed by the world, maybe go back to that question. What's the most meaningful for you? What has the most heart for you? And that doesn't mean that it's easiest, and it doesn't mean that it's the thing that you're best at, but where are you called? So that might be a way to start to find direction. We've been talking about holding an activist support group for sustaining ourselves for the long term. For the long term, where we can explore some of these things in more depth, and I'm going to be starting that hopefully with other people in the beginning of the new year. And we'll let you know on our website, toolsforchange.org, hopefully on the PGL's website, and on our, we actually have a Tools for Change Facebook page too. And what my hope for that is that we create some collective wisdom about what works for you, what works for me, how can we start to support a culture that's going to be sustaining activism for the long term. The woman who is my life partner until she passed in 2010, and I wrote a book called Practical Meditations for Busy Souls. And it's a great book. It starts talking about personal stuff, and it talks about, at the end of the book, how do we work together to for justice and to overcome imperialism, actually. And so it's kind of fun.
Sneak that into a meditation book.
Yes. Yeah, it's pretty awesome that way. At the end of the book, we quote a woman, I'm really bad at names this afternoon, but who is an Australian activist and author. And she talks about, she's worked with Aboriginal people in Australia along with her anti-globalization work. And she says, I want a culture that's going to last for 20,000 years. So when we start to think that long, that's really a powerful kind of image for me. And so how do we start to do that? How do we build for the long term, especially with all the climate change, social craziness that's happening that feels like everything is out of control?
Yeah.
And come and join us in the new year for that. And those are things. Check out my website. There's a bunch of resources on privilege and power, meditation, and communication.
Yeah. And I'll make sure to throw all those links up on the podcast notes for this. Mm-hmm. If you're just joining us at the end of the show, you've been listening to Praxis. I've been talking with my friend Bill All about sustaining your activism for the long haul. If you missed any of the show and you want to catch it, you can find it both by following the link at kyrs.org or by going directly to soundcloud.com/praxisradio, PRAXISRADIO. I wanted to find this Audre Lorde quote before we left. She said, caring for myself is not self-indulgence. It is self-preservation, and that is an act of political warfare.
So brilliant.
I just wanted to end with that. So, yeah. Thank you so much for being with me.
Oh, thanks for having me. It's a pleasure. Look forward to more.
Yeah. All right. Well, I will be back next week with a super spooky Halloween show. Taking submissions if people want to write a super scary story about political stuff, whether lighthearted or not lighthearted, that is welcome. So you can email me at praxis@kyrs.org if you have ideas for that. Thanks, and have a good rest of your day.
Si se puede, it can be done. None can deny your dreams for your daughters and sons. Si se puede, si se puede, it can be done. None can.